Ken Whelan tastes caviar from a rainbow trout.
Let's take one fish. So we've got a hen fish. So you can actually see now, Ken, you know, with gentle squeezing, we can see one or two eggs coming out the vent.
They're coming very freely. Yeah. They're beautiful orange eggs.
I suppose probably 100 grams of caviar, maybe 120 grams, right, from that fish.
Ken, you're in, and you've got the caviar in a little glass jar with you, so we won't get into the whole story yet, but what does it taste like?
It's actually lovely. It's very, very nice. You'll remember the last time I was on the show, I was talking about eating trout caviar in Russia. This is actually quite a different taste, but a very nice taste and quite a nice salty tang off it. I think it would be really lovely. But if I could ask the listeners, we had a great discussion about this. What would go with caviar as a drink? Everyone tells me vodka. I don't drink vodka. What else would they recommend as a drink with caviar?
With caviar. Now, how many of our listeners do you think sit down in the evening to have caviar? Come on!
That's the interesting thing, is that it's now so cheap that people may be trying trout caviar and they may have come up with...
Are these farmed fish, by the way?
These are farmed fish, yeah.
Okay. So they may have come up with something. You don't feel bad about taking the eggs out or anything like that?
Well, the great thing is that all of the fish live after you take the eggs out and go back in.
Well, the fish do.
The fish do. And immediately go back in.
They turn into anything else, only they turn into your belly.
And start feeding again. And they can sell them a second time. I think it's a great idea.
And it's local business?
Yeah, down in Kilkenny.
What's it called?
It's called Goat's Bridge Farm, Trout Farm.
Goat's
Bridge.
Yeah, that's the place where the trout farm
Goat's
is.
Bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, we'll put a little picture of it on the website. Ken wants to know, what would you drink with caviar? How posh is that? Anyway, you want to mention Species Without Borders, which is taking place next Wednesday from 5.30 to 7.30 at UCD.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting debate. I think the listeners will like it. It's the former Secretary General of the North Atlantic Salmon Conservation Organisation, but Malcolm Windsor has had great experience over 25 years dealing with a whole range of international bodies that look after our fisheries and our wildlife. He's going to give what I believe will be quite an outspoken lecture in terms of the pluses and minuses of these international bodies. And we'd love people to come along. It's a public lecture. You just have to register on the UCD website. And we'd love people to come along and join in the debate. And it's being chaired by Frank Condrey. And lots of people will remember Frank when he was a professor in UCD. He's a really top-class environmental economist. I think we're going to have a great evening, and we'd love to see as many Mooney listeners there as we could once they register in advance.
So it's no fee?
It's no fee, and they'll find the website on the Mooney website, and if they just Google Species Without Borders, UCD and Malcolm Windsor, then it'll pop up all over the place and they'll be able to register directly.
Okay, rte.ie/Mooney. So it's Species Without Borders, UCD, next Wednesday, 5.30 to 7.30pm, free of charge. You've just got to register online in advance, 29th of October. Amy, you're going to be there, are you not?
Yes, I'm going to be on the panel. We're having a panel to discuss the implications of this for Ireland once the lecture is given, and I'll be one of the people on the panel. Where in UCD is it? UCD is a big place.
Okay, it's in Science Centre East. It's in the new Science Block, which is just at the back of the church in UCD. That's the easiest way to find it. And if they get to the church and ask anyone for Science Centre East, they'll then have signposts all the way in.
Ken, back to your rainbow trout caviar.
Yes.
So people have been texting in. Caviar and a very dry champagne or sparkling wine or a dry white wine. Have a calm day. Kevin Devitt, Mill Street in Westport. So that's what he suggests. Ken, Guinness all the way. Believe me, it works, as Jim is listening in Limerick.
Fantastic.
But somebody else, with that caviar, I'd recommend a light cure, dry white wine with a tiny glass of creme de cassis. Says Dermot. So they're your suggestions for what you should drink with your little rainbow caviar. But tell us more about it anyway. Yeah.
Yes, Derek. Well, certainly, I talked before about trout caviar in Russia, but Irish caviar was news to me. But it seems it's been in existence for the last 2 years, I'm delighted to say. And I went yesterday to the Goat's Bridge Trout Farm near Thomastown in County Kilkenny. And it's run by Ger and Mag Kirwan. And I knew Ger's dad very well when he was running the business. He's now retired and very well and healthy, I believe. And it's a rainbow trout farm. So these are all fish farm fish that are held in captivity in the rainbow trout farm on a beautiful, beautiful, pretty spring-fed little stream called the Argyle. And it's near Ger Point Abbey. And the interesting thing was that both a fishery And the beginnings of fish farms have been there for 800 years. I thought that was a really interesting fact, because we very often think of fish farms and so on as something very new. But the Kirwans really are very adventurous and they need to add some value to their products. And they decided that maybe by making caviar, they'd be able to add value to the product and open up an export market. So I went along to meet them and Ger gave me the grand tour.
Okay, Ken, so we've walked down now and we're down on the farm itself. So we're at pond number G13. So this was the original pond that my parents started back in 1962, right? You can see here the way the farm is designed. We take the water in, as you can see, from the mill stream.
Okay, well, the mill stream itself looks really, really clear. It's a spring-fed river.
Correct. There are four springs feeding in here, Ken.
And you have a constant volume of water and probably a constant temperature as well coming through.
Yeah, we're operating somewhere between like 8 degrees and 16 degrees. It's limestone water as well, so that's important in terms of fish love alkaline conditions. And, you know, you can see the vigour straight away when you walk down here, that these fish are, they're active and they're swimming against a good current of flow, so that it's all building good, strong muscle.
And as we look across the pond there now, all we can see are thousands of backs, or what appear to me to be thousands of backs. How many fish are on the farm at peak?
Well, we could potentially have 500,000 between small, medium, large, extra large. So that'd be the kind of number.
In a relatively small area.
I mean, yeah, well, interesting. People talk about this being like a fish farming being an intensive farming operation. But, you know, yeah, you're seeing a lot more fish than you'll see in a wild context. We're still only stocking at 15 to 20 kilograms per cubic meter, which, like, you know, you'll know, Ken, that, you know, you've probably visited eel farms or you've probably visited other types of aquaculture units where the stocking rates have been up to 100 kilograms per cubic meter and you could walk across the water.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. And you can see here that the fish actually are very comfortable. They're very much at ease and they've lots of room. You can actually see lots of space between them. So they're obviously doing very well. And in terms of the actual food then that the fish are feeding on, is it all artificial food that you're putting in, or do they supplement that with some food from the stream?
For years, in the early years, it was all wet feed. So what you did was you sourced waste fish, fish offal from around the coast. You brought it back to Goatsbridge, you minced it. It could go in from being really top quality to being kind of rank. So it was a kind of a balancing act. But formulated diets then were developed, and, you know, similar for farming, for agricultural farming.
And the fish themselves then are fed on little pellets, very much like little horse nuts, tiny little horse nuts.
Yeah, so like it would be an extension of what you see like in your with your pet fish, for example. Like, so generally, like right at the early stages, you did mention there's a certain amount of natural feed in the water because there's a fresh supply all the time. On top of that, you're supplementing that then with, at the start, when their aladins are just swimming up, you're starting at a very minute fine dust. And then accordingly, as the fish grow from fry to fingerling to the grower sizes, the millimetre size of that pood, it'll be a crumb then. It'll then go to a 1.5 millimetre pellet, a 3 mil pellet. And laterally then, if you're going for fish maybe in excess of a kilo, it would be a 6 mil or an 8 mil pellet.
Ger, when we're looking at the pond there, there's an extraordinary thing happening. At times the pond is almost flat calm, and then suddenly there's this peak of activity where almost every fish in the pond is actually appearing on the surface. Is there a reason for that?
It's called feeding time at the zoo, Ken. When there's activity on the track, okay, they're expecting that we're going to feed them. So even like a hand action to reflect that you're throwing in food is causing them to actually surge forward, because they're expecting, you know, people get the concept that it's ranching or it's factory rearing, but no, like it's all, like all these fish are hand fed.
And Ger, we seem to be almost sitting in a cage here, because there's wires running above us, but they're very densely packed, these wires. What are they for?
Okay, so like as you're aware, Ken, like some of our wildlife come into Goatsbridge, like it's like landing in heaven. What we have is we have a predation netting overhead, birds that can come in and prey on the fish.
And what about predators coming in by land? Do you have issues with otters?
Yeah, well, we see some otters, but like again, you know, everything is fenced off. So in the main, we're able to keep them out and not have a problem. But you know, over 50 years on a fish farm, yeah, I've seen everything. And the two-footed predator is
the humankind.
Throughout the 90s, we grew large amounts of trout and sold them. But we kind of were searching, because every year we'd go like on a busman's holiday somewhere. And we went to the Boston Seafood Show in maybe 2008, looking for ideas. And we came upon a trout farm that had their own stand there called Sunburst Trout Farm. They're based in North Carolina. What they were doing was every fish was, they were adding value in some form or other. The caviar one they had there, and we were taken by the idea. So subsequently, we actually invited ourselves over to North Carolina, saw how they were doing it, and we actually had like mature trout that we started the process of developing our own caviar, Ireland's first trout caviar, which went on the market in January, February 2012.
It might be worthwhile, Ger, maybe just going back a step for the listeners in terms of explaining to them about the maturation process inside a female rainbow and the choices you have in terms of when you might take the eggs.
Okay, yeah, so I suppose the first thing to say is that rainbow trout are a member of the salmon family. In terms of the life cycle, what happens, like in our site here, like in a controlled environment, is very similar to what happens in the wild with brown trout or with wild salmon. First of all, we refer to the male as the cockfish. We refer to the female as the henfish. Maturity will normally be 3 years or 4 years. At that stage, the fish would be maybe anywhere between 1 and 2 kilos, okay? The normal maturity cycle for whether it be the salmon, brown trout or rainbows is maybe late October up to February. Like if you'll hear now that, you know, salmon are running in the rivers, they're going upstream and they're going back to the rivers of their origin. Well, like our fish will mature as normal in a controlled environment, right? But the rainbow originated in the US, their cycle is such that they don't spawn naturally. So, but they mature as normal. So upon ripening then, like what happens is, with that female, like we have a number of choices. We can take like that egg from that female, right? By upon ripening, the egg is contained within a membrane sac, and upon ripening, that membrane sac is absorbed. And at that stage then, the eggs, it's possible to squeeze them gently, and they'll come out through a vent just located at the back passage, a separate vent. That term technically is known as stripping. With those fish, we could actually take the milt, or the as it's known, or the sperm from the male, and in a bowl we could actually fertilize them and incubate them in the hatchery and hatch them and use them for next generation stock, or using the small number of mature fish to best effect with a completely new and wacky idea.
So it's the unfertilized eggs then are really the basis for your caviar.
Yeah. Okay, Ken, so we've made our way down here to I suppose the breeding station. What we've done is selected a number of female fish that are approaching maturity. A number of them are ripe. I've got my gear and equipment on for handling.
Great. So okay, well let's have a look then at these fish.
Yeah. So I'm just going to take the lid off the tank here.
Okay, let's have a look.
Yep.
Oh, they're beautiful looking fish. I presume that big tank that we're looking at the side here is just to keep them oxygenated.
Yeah. You know, that would allow you to even transport them by road in the back of the car.
They certainly look very happy. So just to describe then what you're actually going to do. So you're going to take the adult fish then out of the pond here. You're going to turn them upside down and run your fingers then, if I get it, along the tummy, just to see if or not the eggs are running freely.
Yeah. The technical term for this one is to strip, or stripping. Okay, so there's no swinging of my hips. What I do is, we're dealing with a living fish. I actually hold them in my left hand by the tail, okay? And as you see, I've got a net glove that'll grip those. So with my right hand then, I'm gently squeezing. You know, if the fish is ripe, you'll see those eggs, and we'll put those in a bowl. If not, I'll just carry that fish down and I'll return it to the pond and look at that fish again in 2 weeks. Okay, so once I put the net in, you'll see there'll be a bit of splashing around, and the fish will you know, they want to get away from the net. So I'm just going to lift one or two and we'll see what we can come up with. Okay.
Okay.
So straight away, Ken, you can see here. Let's take one fish. So we've got a hen fish,
and you can just see the vent. Coming out exactly as you described, just at the fin near the tail, which is the anal fin.
You know, if you look down vertically, that fish will say to yourself, gosh, brown trout. But when you turn it to the side, you see the streaks of the rainbow. So, like, as you're aware, when the rainbow was introduced to Ireland first, it was actually crossed with the brown. And there's 250 species of rainbow, like, so you're going to get, like, the different strains. We lift another one, and he might be slightly more silver, or slightly more darker, or more... So that's the idea. So we're gonna just take that. So I generally hold it, and we straight away detected that this fish is ripe. Okay, because you know with gentle squeezing we can see one or two eggs coming out the vent. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm restraining the fish with my left hand by the tail, angling the fish slightly so that it's almost flowing out
and
the rear end.
The back of the fish is against your tummy.
Exactly.
And then you're going to run your fingers along the tummy of the fish, which is facing away from you.
I'm squeezing the eggs from the fish on one side with my thumb and on the other side with my first finger. I'm going in just below the gill fin and I'm just working my way down.
But you're very much doing that the same as somebody would very, very gently milk a cow.
Correct.
You're just milking the eggs out.
So you can actually see now, Ken, that the eggs are coming from this one.
Oh, they're coming very freely. Yeah, yeah. They're beautiful orange eggs. So what you're looking at there is a fish of maybe 2.5 pounds. So you're going to get roughly, you're going to get maybe about 1,500 eggs out of that fish.
Yeah. I may have left one egg. What will happen to this fish now is he'll go back into like a fattening pond. He'll be sold like as a large trout. But we've got probably 100 grams of caviar, maybe 120 grams right from that fish, right? Perfectly formed, beautiful colour. So what you have there in value, if you look at that, the retail price for an 85 gram jar of caviar is €12.95. His market value in a physical size is probably somewhere between 7 and 10 euro for his meat content. Okay. So straight away what you've done is you've almost moved 1.5 to 2x his value, his meat value in the caviar.
It also has the advantage that it makes caviar available to the ordinary man in the street, whereas before this caviar might have had a cachet about it that actually inhibited people really from trying it.
Yeah. We'd have customers come in here and literally they'd buy a jar, and particularly the Eastern Europeans, it's part of their culture. So they'd buy a jar and before they'd be gone out the yard, the jar would be eaten. Like maybe 10, 12 euros, 15 euros, they think on that. And what it's doing for them is it's sparking a reminder of home. Like for us, like Margaret's mother rang, I think the morning we launched the product, and she said to Margaret, I think it's far from caviar we were reared. But like, we shouldn't shy away from, I mean, fish has been part of what we're about all those years. And I mean, the thing about it is, this is just an extension of that.
Jared, on a commercial day, if you were doing this now with a big order coming in and so on, how many fish would you actually strip?
I suppose what I generally tend to do is somewhere between 500 and 1,000 fish.
Oh, that's a lot of work.
But it's very physical.
It is.
I'm a big guy, but it's very physical.
Yeah.
Because you're the muscle, particularly in the left hand, is you're dealing with something that can move and shake. So you've got to try and anchor them. Because if they can get the first move on you, like they'll hurt your shoulder. Like they're very, very strong. A 1 kilo rainbow is the equivalent of a 2 kilo brown in terms of fight, we say, when you're rod fishing. And similarly, it's the same here. They're strong.
Well, Jerry, we have a nice bowl of orange eggs there now. So what's the next step in the process and where do we head to now?
Okay, so we're going to head up to the factory, which is located just adjacent to the house here. So the process takes all in probably about an 8-hour process.
But. Great, okay, well, I can't wait.
Okay, Ken, so we've walked, as I said, up into the backyard, and here we're just about to enter a 400 square metre food processing premises, right? I'll introduce you to my wife, Margaret, here, and she's involved in getting the caviar from the raw state into the finished product.
And Margaret, you're going to show us exactly what's involved in actually making the caviar.
Okay, yeah, this is very simple, really. First thing we do is we wash the eggs in a 0.6% salt solution. And after that, then, we drain the water from the eggs and we cure it in a 3% salt solution. Very, very simply, by tumbling it. We jar them and we pasteurise them. It's all done by hand. At the moment, all done by me, but that's about to change.
Yeah.
But we do a small amount. We don't mass produce this product. And this jar of caviar that I have here in front of me in my bowl, that jar is just stripped. I'm going to cure this today and I'm going to bottle that and we're going to use it at our feast. We're having there's an event happening on Sunday night. It's called the Night of 1,000 Feasts. And it's a very simple notion where people are going to get together in their houses and their families and their communities. We're all having a big dinner party.
Well, Margaret, I've come a long way and I see you have a lovely jar of caviar in your hand. Is there any chance that I could taste some of it?
No problem at all. Now, what you see I have here in my hand is an ivory spoon.
I'm honoured indeed.
Yes, so what we do is we get some of the just best way to taste this is simply on its own. And put it on the back of your hand here and you see the lovely gold, orange colour. I mean, it smells just absolutely delicious. It's fresh. It's
oh, that's absolutely superb. Oh, that is really, really, really good. And there's a beautiful hint of sort of saltiness about it. It's really nice.
Now, if I had some vodka, I'll give you a shot of that.
Well, Ger and Margaret, thank you very much indeed for all the time you've spent with me this morning. I enjoyed that. It was really interesting. And the very best of luck with the trout caviar. I think that's a fantastic niche product. So I hope it goes really well for you.
I'm just wondering, Ken, how many fish does he actually have to strip to fill one jar?
Ger was saying to us yesterday that on average, he gets about 700 eggs per pound body weight. So each of the fish we were stripping yesterday, which were about a kilo, there was in around 1,400 eggs. So two fish would just about, I think, give you one of their nice jars full of the nice orange eggs.
And did you say 500,000 fish?
Yeah, 500,000 fish.
So and how do they control disease, the spread of disease, if they're in a confined area?
That's probably the biggest challenge that they have. And they have to be really cautious in relation to flow rates of the water coming in, the quality of the water coming in, and also the area under which each pond is, so that they have a certain number of fish that a pond can take at a maximum, and they work below that to make sure that the fish are comfortable and have enough space. We actually asked that question yesterday, and it was quite interesting that we could see at the edge of what was apparently a great mass of fish, there was lots and lots of room for fish to actually move out and to spread out in
but
the ponds.
Didn't.
They did move once there was no disturbance. Once they see anybody walk across the walkways, and the walkways are above the ponds, they immediately think they're going to be fed, and they all trash about.
Yeah, but you're saying, though, there were areas where there were no fish.
Yeah.
So they were all huddled all the time.
They were huddled because
are
we
they
were,
huddlers?
Because we were there. They're not huddlers generally, in the sense that if you weren't there at all, and there was one pond near us, you could see fins absolutely everywhere where they were just spread out and they were nice and comfortable. But obviously, like any farm animal, they're going to realise that they get fed from a certain pattern.
So you're coming with the food and they all cuddle together.
Particularly if you're, as I do all the time, move your hands and you're gesticulating, well, they think you're throwing in food, so they start to move about. But it was there was no sign of disease on the fish. Fish looked really very healthy. And we were making a point yesterday, and it always was a remarkable feature of people who are used to dealing with fish. There was a colleague of mine, Deirdre Cotter, now, and she's an absolute wizard at this. Deirdre could walk around a pond of 10 or 20,000 baby salmon, and just by the actual behaviour of the fish, she would know days in advance of you knowing if there was any small infestation of a little parasite or whatever, just by the pattern of movement of the fish. So Ger is constantly walking up and down those ponds, basically just looking at the fish and making sure that...
So if there was one ill fish among them, the rest would be staying away, sort of
thing? Well, certainly if there's an ill fish, that they may not stay away, but the fish that was ill, that would have to be taken out and then looked at to see whether or not it had any obvious signs of disease. And if it hadn't, then it'd be sent off then immediately for analysis.
And then when they're stripping them down at the eggs to get the eggs out, I mean, they're putting them into a separate pond, presumably. They're not throwing them back in with all the other fish because, well, you've already stripped that one. There you go again. And you keep pulling the same ones out.
Well,
it's very labour-intensive.
It relates back to your question about disease as well. In the world of fish, around spawning time is the time when you're most likely to get disease. You might remember many years ago when we were down looking at salmon spawning, mm-hmm. that some of the salmon actually had some fungus on them, and we remarked on that. It's very common around spawning
time. They look
knackered,
actually.
Yeah, and they can get very weakened and so on when they're spawning. So you have to be really careful to keep them separate from the fish that are maiden fish and the fish that you're going to feed on. So the lower pool that he put them into then, he was saying the fish that have been stripped, he's going to sell as fish and February, so they go into a completely separate pond at the end of the farm. They're fed back up again into full health, and then they're sold on then around February time. So he gets a double blow. That's the added value, if you like. He gets the value of the
eggs. But how many years before maturity, so he can strip them and then sell them on for the plate?
Well, it's only in terms of these fish now, it's taken him about 18 months to 2 years to grow them to the kilo weight, and it's only between now and February is the only extra feeding that he has to do.
If he didn't sell them, would they come into eggs again a second time?
Oh, they would. And we asked him about that because it might be logical, we said, maybe to keep them, and you could indeed keep them for several years. But he said the big risk was that in doing what we're doing, he wants to get eggs from just maiden fish because they make by far the best caviar. As fish get older, the female fish get older, this is true in the wild as well, you get a situation where the eggs are not of the same quality in the second or third stripping or spawning. So he was conscious of that, and he said, no, we made a business decision that we're going to go for maiden fish only, first time they were stripped, high quality eggs into the jar, and then they could guarantee them.
Ken, just a very quick mention of your lecture again on Wednesday.
Yeah, the lecture's on Wednesday. It's on 5:30 to 7:30. It's in Science Centre East in UCD, and we'd love to see people come along and debate the whole question of the international management of wildlife.
And details for where you can register, because you can't just turn up. You've got to register. It's free, but they need you to register in advance. rte.ie/Munich.